We only had 2 meetings a week, and people like Bob had allowed to be taped for a very important part of my sobriety. Because it was kind of rough when I get down in my own doldrums and stuff, I just take a tape, and boy, that guy sure had a hell of a lot worse than I did, you know. you know, we all got to hit our bottom, and where it is. But keep reminding us we come from is very important to me, and that's the reason I keep coming back to meeting the convention. So without any further ado, I'll introduce Bobby.
According to a package of tapes out here, I see I am the Bob of Earl, so drug addict and alcoholic. They got him all smashed under here. He wants to come out. There. Much better. God, it's nice to still be able to attend a convention of Alcoholics Anonymous before they're all, you know, behind barbed wire with armed guards, and we have to give a pass to prove we're a real alcoholic in order to get in. For those of you who aren't privileged to that movement, hang on. It's coming. Oh, God, we're so silly, I can't believe it. It's been a rotten week, so I'm going to talk about it for a minute first, otherwise I'll be just completely disconnected. You know, it started last Friday. I had to get on a plane to go to Houston, and I hit my head on the trunk lid of my wife's car, and I had been having a bad week, but I had been being a good boy. You know, I'd been being a good AA and a good boy, meaning I wasn't expressing any feelings. So the hitting the head just sort of uncorked the feeling, so I immediately turned around and kicked the shit out of the side of my car and broke my toe. And as I had all these planes booked to get into Houston, and the decision was, do we get the toe fixed in Santa Fe and change all the airplane flights and make new arrangements with the people that have to pick us up, or, you know, do we fly to Houston? Having very little regard for myself, I flew to Houston with a broken toe and got it fixed there. The weekend went pretty good. And then Wednesday we left to come here. Coming over the mountain, the snow started, the windshield wipers froze, wouldn't work. My wife is 7 months pregnant, and she has had terrible asthma all her life due to allergies. And when she catches a cold or anything, it just goes right to the chest. And what it was like to breathe becomes a memory. And it's not anything she's conscious of at the moment. So I've been at your medical center since 7 o'clock this morning with her, and down with this chest thing, and everybody, you know, she's, of course, scared to death about the baby, and the baby's fine, she's fine, and everything will be fine. So this is what a speaker looks like. It's been up at medical since 7 o'clock. I don't suggest you hug me after. My breath would probably stop a truck. So for those of you who have come with any, you know, glorious preconceived ideas about Bobby E. or and how controlled he is, contained, and I can't believe you've ever heard me and would believe that, here it is. Welcome to Yosemite. For me, when I like to remember what it used to be like, it starts with when I got to the program. I mean, if you're brand new, people always, one of the raps I hear all the time is, well, he doesn't say anything for the newcomer. Well, you know, too bad. Jesus. There's a lot of people talking to the newcomer, you know, and there's a lot of people telling their story. And my concern is the fact that we should be 5 million strong now, and we aren't. You know, that's what gets my attention. So I like to talk to the guy that's or the gal who's 2, 3, 3.5 and wants to die. And wonders why nobody told them this when they got sober. Part of the initiation fee is you're going to want to kill yourself shortly. You may never have thought about killing yourself before in sobriety at any time drinking, but wait, in sobriety you will think about killing yourself. So I like to talk about what recovery's been like because I've made a lot of discoveries for me. And before you mash your teeth or chew up your tongue or anything, remember that everything I say up here is just my experience and just my opinion. Guys, yours may be different from mine. You may absolutely, completely, totally disagree with me. That doesn't mean that either one of us is wrong. And I think that's a real misconception that gets going around the hallowed halls of AA, that there's only room for one opinion. No, no, no. There's room, if there's 30 people in the room, there's room for 30 opinions, and nobody's wrong. We got to stop this. There's a, you know, when anybody gets up and says to you, this is the only way, they're leaving out two real important words. For me. See, that's the words that I don't hear. And that's the stuff, I'm just here to talk about what's worked for me. I'm here to tell you what's been necessary for me in recovery. It may never become necessary for you. You may disagree with it. It may be unimportant to you. It may sound like heresy to you. It may sound like witchcraft. You may think I'm sitting back in the hills of New Mexico killing chickens, you know, having ceremonies to further my recovery. I just tell you, you know, we got just so much of this stuff going on about who's an alcoholic and who's a drug addict and who's a this and that. Like I'm not an acceptable speaker to Narcotics Anonymous. They don't allow me to speak at their functions. Of course, I've always identified myself as a drug addict for 25 years, but that's unimportant, I guess, to them. And they have their own little rules, and you never want to mention the word sobriety, of course, you know. And of course now in AA we're having a backlash which is about just equally as dangerous, you know, where they're going to go undercover with some meetings and permission is being given to read two different preambles. And one of the first 100 members of AA lives in Eastridge and he runs a small community in the Catskill Mountains in New York. His name is Tom Powers. Maybe we can learn from him. He started a thing back there called All Addicts Anonymous, AAA. Just to cut through the bullshit, you know. You got a problem, you're addicted to something, come to the meeting. You know. Because I think, see, for me, that real tunnel vision, for me, is very dangerous. And initially, in initial recovery, it was okay. You know, the first few months, I mean, I think you just need to focus on the fact that you can't handle chemicals anymore. End of comment, you know. Whatever they once did, whatever joy was once in them, whatever they once gave you, it ain't there anymore. It's time to do something about it. It's like backlash time. Okay, so you got to focus for that on that for a while. But I think one of the things I missed by making that my focus for years and years and years and years is that there's all kinds of addictions. And that usually if you give up a primary addiction, a really strong, all-consuming addiction like drugs or alcohol, or people, for those of you who are Al-Anons, hey, it's an addiction too, you know. You don't think it ain't energy living with one of us and getting high off our behavior, you know. A lot of control too, you know. A lot of control. It's an addiction, just like that codependent behavior, which I guess is a term Al-Anon hates. I don't know. I've heard that they don't like it. Is an addiction like anything else, you know? And if you give up drugs and alcohol, and what do you got? You know, go to a meeting, man. Watch it. Give it a coffee, sugar, mainline, you know. Food, relationships, you know, anything, you know. Cars, work. Oh, yeah, he's a good AA. Works 16 hours a day. My God, he's vice president of his company. You know, what the hell ever happened to him? I don't know. I heard he killed himself. So I had to learn about all these other addictions in order to survive the 25 years that I've survived clean and sober. But without that, I wouldn't be here today. And I wouldn't be here today in great health, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and physically, looking forward to maybe another, I don't know, 80 years. You know, I remember that line, somebody, I don't know who said it, but somebody said once upon a time that, you know, if I knew I was going to live this long, I would have taken better care of myself. Okay, so I think that both of us are addicts and alcoholics. We had our big ride, you know? Now it's time to wake up to the reality that you may just live that long, you know? You may just live that long. I remember one time an old-timer in AA, you know, a respected old-timer at one of the respected Polano clubs in Southern California, was mistakenly asked to speak at one of the young people's meetings, and he said that he felt very sorry for all the young people in the room. His heart went out to them because they were going to live too long to stay sober the rest of their lives. Tell you anything about where he was at? Where his program was at? You know? And I don't want to spend my life waiting to die. So, how have I avoided that? Glad you asked. Well, the first thing I discovered is in essence, when I was born, we're going way back, aren't we, to this one. When I was born, I came down the chute, pardon me, women, happy, joyous, and free. I mean, that's the way I hit this planet. I hit this planet as God intended me to be, happy, joyous, and free. Unfortunately, I was born into an alcoholic household that knew nothing about happiness, joy, or freedom. They only knew about denial, secrecy, abuse, and control. Guess who was the object of the control? So I look at it like this. I look at it like once I started, you know, to get any sense of reality, these people that raised me just fragmented me into a thousand pieces. Man, they scattered me like a picture puzzle all over the planet. I mean, that's really what happened. So I come into the program of, after years of drug addiction and alcoholism, I come into the programs of Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous, and I start to put my life back together. And a lot of people, because I talk about it, I think a lot of things are important to recovery. I think good nutrition is important to recovery. I think regular physical exercise is important to recovery. We yell and scream at meetings about how we have a physical disease and then don't do a goddamn thing about it in recovery. You know, that doesn't make any sense to me, you know. I think every kind of tool you need to use, you individually need to use for your own recovery, is wonderful. If it's therapy, it's therapy. See, there's a lot of information here. And they said in the big book, God will constantly disclose more to you and to me. But boy, there's tons of information in today that wasn't in 50 years ago, and yet it seems like we're trying to ignore it. There's tons of documented proof now about what you eat and your mental health and depression, you know. There's all kinds of physical problems that lead to depression, and I find myself constantly surrounded by people who try and pretend that somehow if you work a step, it will fix everything, you know? Doesn't mean that just because the steps won't fix everything, doesn't mean there's anything wrong with the steps. They were never intended to fix everything. And a good example of it would be one of our founders, Bill, for Christ's sake, was plagued by depressions for most of his recovery. And then finally, one day, through a physical, they found out he was hypothyroid. And so he went to the doctors and they treated it. It's a simple hormone. You take a simple hormone and it corrects the body chemistry. Yeah, it didn't eliminate his depressions, but it alleviated them a lot. It made them much better. They weren't as severe. So for those of you who have been sober for a while out there, when's the last time you were working with somebody, you know, those particularly really good babies that drive you nuts, you know, the kind that you have them work a step and they do and they're crazier after they work it than they were before. They write their inventory and call you 3 days later, they want to kill themselves, you know. They turn their will and their life over to God and they wreck their car, they wind up in the hospital, they lose their job and call you and say, what the fuck is this stuff, you know. I surrender to God and here I am, man. Things are that good. And a chronic, or for the women who are more prone to express their emotion than we guys are, you know, you get a baby who cries all the time and she can't stop and she's really emotional and she's really depressed. When's the last time any one of you took one of these people, stuck them in a car, and took them to a good doctor for a physical? And 5 years later, I needed a lot of stuff in recovery. I mean, I've had to learn how to eat right. I've had to learn how to not smoke. I've had to learn how to exercise. I've had 8.5 years of intensive therapy, man, to keep me from killing myself when I was 17 years sober. You know, because I had to get to stuff that I didn't know I had to get to. See, one of my problems is being raised. See, this program, the beauty of AA for me is this. This person that I once was, that was scattered like a picture puzzle to the wind, the Alcoholics Anonymous, the program and the fellowship, for me, it's like a table. It's like a real solid table with real sturdy legs. And on this table, I'm putting me back together. I'm getting a little piece here and a piece here and a piece here, and I'm putting this picture puzzle back together on this table. Without the table, I got no place to put the puzzle. The table's critical. The table is the foundation on which I build. But just because I got the table doesn't mean that I stop. It doesn't mean that I give up. Because one of my problems, not having an identity, growing up in an alcoholic household, is I found myself constantly creating people. I became whatever I had to become to keep from getting killed. It was that simple. Dad wants to laugh. Hi, Dad! Ain't my fault, man. Don't kill me. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't work. Sometimes you get killed anyway, but you try. Quiet, small, make yourself small. I always find that I live in small spaces. I made myself little. I tried to stay out of sight all the time. And as I grew up, I didn't lose any of this. I found myself constantly in any kind of situation where there was people, and I'd have to create somebody. I'd have to become whatever they were. If I want, and I'd have to go in a room full of people and watch them, see how they behaved, and how did they talk, and how did they stand, and how did they laugh, and I would do that. I would emulate that behavior. And the tragedy of doing that is that whoever I am, whatever I am, I'm ignoring him. I'm leaving him back here on the wall because he's not good enough. He's not a good enough person. So I do that behavior all my life, and I come into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't change. It don't change. I didn't feel any more like I belonged here than I did at the Kiwanis Club, for Christ's sake. I'm a raging drug-addicted armed robber, and I haven't heard them ask any of them in the Kiwanis Club lately, So I didn't feel any more fit in. This is my family. I'm here with folks. This is this great bullshit. I felt as afraid, as different, as flawed. See, my secret all my life has been that there's something wrong with me. Something wrong with me. And so I can't ever let you see the real me because I'm flawed. Now, one of the tragedies of that is I demand of you that you be perfect if you be part of my life. Then the minute you show me a flaw, I'll throw you away. I'll get rid of you. And we're talking wife, child, friend, employer, lecturer, teacher. I'll throw you, man. The minute you're flawed, I'll throw you away. Why? Am I a bad guy? No, because that's what I've done to me. That's what I've done to me. I think I'm flawed, so I've thrown me away. So I come in here to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't feel any more comfortable than anything else, so I do what I've done all my life. I watch the people. I don't want you to make me go away, and I don't want you to know that I'm flawed. So, how do you do that? You become one of them. So you watch them, and you become a good AA. I became a good AA. I created my version, my interpretation, may not be yours, but it's mine, my interpretation of a good AA. Now, one of the things I learned that's critical to being a good AA is that you're always fine. Doesn't matter what's happening in your life, you're fine. And you learn this from first-hand experience. I'd go up before a meeting, I'd walk up to Bill and say, "Hi, Bill, how are you?" And Bill say, "I'm fine, thanks." And walk off. And then George would rush up and say, "My God, did you hear what happened to Bill?" "No, what happened to Bill?" "Oh, God, his wife served him with divorce papers this morning. They fired him at work. They repossessed his car." "Oh, okay, I understand. No matter what happens, you're fine." Okay? Then I learned that you don't express feeling. Men don't cry. Well, I've known that all my life. I've carried that one into complete, ridiculous, insane extremes. The showing of emotion of any kind, fear or tears. So, because I was taught by my dad not to cry. Most men I know in AA learned the same way I learned. You were a little child, you came in, you hurt yourself, you were crying, and you were told to stop. And you couldn't stop. And they told you if you couldn't stop, they'd give you a reason to cry. And I kept crying, and they showed me. You know, I got decked, man, dropped like a sack of potatoes, and I learned not to cry. I carried that to such an extreme that one time I laid in Georgia Street receiving a hospital in downtown Los Angeles with a couple of bullets in me belonging to the Los Angeles Police Department, and I told the surgeon to take his anesthesia and stick it in his ass. My father would have been proud. I unfortunately fainted about 3 seconds later. But I had a minute, you know, right? When you have no real identity, that's all you're looking for is one good minute. You know, I just have one good minute. I'll take 3 years of pure bullshit if I just have one good minute of glory. My need to be accepted and loved by others was so great. I remember every time I'd be on an airplane, I'd think, God, if a plane would crash, I could, you know, get like at the door over the chute, you know, and I could pull people out of this burning airplane. You know, I could be responsible for saving half the people on this airplane and help them down the chute. I mean, I could see myself standing there afterwards, you know, after half the people die, half the people live, and I could see myself on, you know, the 7 o'clock news with my arms bandaged, you know, wrapped up from being burned by the flames as I rescued people, and they're, you know, talking about what a hero I am. Because I'm so flawed, I think I need that for you to like me. If I could just get that, you'll like me. You know? Now, the one thing that never dawned on me is I'm willing for half a plane full of people to die just so I can look good. See? I'm willing for the other half to go. Used to, on the freeway, they used to think about families and cars would crash and a car would catch on fire. And I'd save half the family and the other half would go to the great beyond. And again, I'd be on the news and be interviewed. This is in sobriety, guys. Okay? I'm not talking about pre-sobriety. This is flying places to speak at the convention. Thinking maybe I can save 175 and 175 will die, but I'll look good. You know, I'll have that one moment because I'm so flawed. So now I know that I've got to be fine all the time and I can't show feelings. Because there's a lot of misinterpretation of the thing about anger in the book. You know, about we can't afford anger even justifiable. I think most of the people I've run into interpret that to mean you can't have it. I think what they mean is don't keep it. You know? Don't clutch it to you. In other words, get it out. See? So, because I kept it with me for a week. And watch out for my left foot, you know, after the meeting's over, because that's the result. I kicked in the side of my car because I kept it contained. See, I think you can create a lot of dangerous personalities. I live in New Mexico, and we have a lot of Zen Buddhists. And I always envy them. I always wanted to be like them. You know, it's like, you know, they give you the impression at a distance that just, you know, everything around them could explode in flame, and they would walk quietly through. Undisturbed. But if you get really close to them, and I've had a chance to get close to some in a real intimate setting in a sweat lodge in New Mexico, they get me real nervous because I'm afraid there's going to be a loud noise and they're going to unwind like a cheap watch. You know? Because you can't constrain yourself that much. You can't control yourself that much without something having to give. And that's what the anger, see, it doesn't mean don't express it, it just means don't carry it around with you. But I didn't see any feeling at meetings. There was no feeling. You know, everybody was quiet and calm and fine and nice quotes out of the AA book. So I became quiet, calm, fine. It's like I created what I call my recovery personality. And it's like a Superman cape. And I would put it on in the parking lot outside the meeting. After driving down the freeway 30 miles to get to the meeting, threatening the lives of 7 people, chasing people at 100 miles an hour to, you know, just a normal, quiet drive to the meeting, I would then exit my car and take this lunatic, leave him in the car, slip into Bob E. Alcoholic. How are you, Bob? I'm fine. And if the people like you, around you, like the personality that you create, they'll ask him to talk, the personality. Not you, they don't hear anything you got to say. Because if you told them what it was really like, you get up the podium, you cry, scream, shout, bang on the podium, turn the goddamn table over and crumple into a, you know, whining, sniffling ball on the floor. They don't want that, so they'll ask this identity, you know, a statue actually, to speak. And then if you, more people like them, more people ask them to speak, and you keep taking the statue around. It's like you become, you create a personality, and then you become maintenance man and janitor. For the statue, you know, just cleaning the bird shit off, you know, and carrying them from meeting to meeting, you know, and you can, if you want to know how to tell whether you're really in trouble, watch how severe your need for control is. I mean, like, did you go to always the same meetings? Parking always the same spot? Drink out of the same cup? Sit in the same chair? Wait until the same time on the watch to speak at the meeting, whether it's first, middle, or last, you know. And if you find yourself pulling your world in, it's because there is no you. It's because you got a fake person living out there. And you get smaller and smaller, and you pull your world in littler and littler. I live, and I have a skylight in the bathroom in the house in which I live, and sometimes I find myself afraid to look up. I just don't want to let myself go that much. I don't want to let myself that far out of the room, you know, because from there I can see nothing but blue sky as far as I can see through the tree branches. But I don't want to look up sometimes. I'm too afraid. I'm too afraid to just let myself go. Well, that's sad. That's really sad, you know, that I can make myself such a prisoner. So I walk around this joint, you know, like this, with this personality. People like me, hell, you know, they were asking me to speak when I wasn't even, you know, a year sober. Sponsors were taking me along. And I was comfortable with my sponsorship because my sponsorship resembled my home life as an alcoholic. I mean, as a child growing up with alcoholics. I find that a lot of us who were raised by alcoholics have a tendency to pick identical kind of folks for sponsors. My sponsors treated me like an asshole. I mean, you know, they screamed at me, yelled at me, you know, threatened me. I mean, sit down, shut up, you don't talk for 90 goddamn days, move in, make the coffee, we ain't interested in anything you gotta say. I thought, well, this is comfortable, you know, this is, it's like home here, you know, no stress. And I'm, by the way, I'm not saying that's bad. I don't know if that's good or bad. I really don't have an opinion on it. I'm just saying that's what it was. You know, I might not have been able to, had some man come up to me and sat down with me and said to me, Bob, I want you to know that you are a beautiful, sensitive, goddamn human being. And inside of you, a very, very gentle, wonderful child lives. And I got to tell you, we're going to help you find that child and nurture you back to life. It might not have been in my book, you know. I might have said some real unkind things. So maybe that initial, you know, is okay. Maybe it's very good. Maybe it's exactly what we need. See, the thing, people misinterpret so much of what I say. They think I'm saying, oh, sponsorship's terrible. The way, no, I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying just because it's worked that way great the first year doesn't mean you got to put up with it for 20. You know? I mean, if what they say is we're going to change, then we're going to change. And the kind of sponsorship that works for me when I'm 3 months clean and sober will not work for me when I'm 3 years clean and sober. Absolutely will not work. Because I've changed. I need different stuff now. I need more information now. I need different kinds of information now. My focus is no longer on... I'll say this one, which I know is going to curl some toes. But I'm fairly convinced based on my, because this happened to me and it's happened to a lot of my friends. I'll tell you what, goddammit, there's going to be a day in your recovery, like there was a day in my recovery when being grateful or being sober, period, is no longer enough. It won't hold you up. It's great in the beginning, but there becomes a point. You better find out who lived in here. See? Or you're going to die. I almost died. Anyway, I don't know the story. Jeez. I was going to try and stay out of some of that stuff. It's so pretty up here. C- controversial. No, 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 no. Not me. Opinionated, perhaps. I'm only controversial if you disagree. Alan gets you upset because I've been known to change my mind on the way home. You know, so... You spend your next 3 weeks taking Maalox and chewing up the old clubhouse. That son of a bitch. You hear what he said? You know, I might have already gone, why the hell did I say that? That doesn't make any sense. Well, you know. So once I will create this personality and everybody loves them and I'm walking around in meetings, I have a little problem. The insides and the outsides don't match up. The insides, I'm coming apart, man. I'm unwinding, absolutely coming apart. I'm crazier than I ever was when I took drugs or drank alcohol. I never got as nuts as I was. I'm driving down the freeway, picking out the concrete abutment that I'm going to drive into. So at least... You know, none of my babies will feel bad. They'll think it was an accident. You know, oh, got out of control. You know, ran into the cement thing and died. You know, but I'm thinking about dying. I'm going to these meetings and all I can think about is dying. It seems I wake up in the morning and forget the goddamn serenity prayer. I have one alternative to the day. That's suicide. You know, what do you want to do today, Bob? Go through this day or kill yourself? Well, killing myself sounds really good. I don't want to go through this day. I can't take anymore. But I walk in that meeting, somebody says, how are you, Bob? I say, I'm fine, thanks. How are you? What I should have done, if I could have done it, okay, when somebody said, how are you? I should have just dropped to my knees, grabbed them around the ankles, and started to sob uncontrollably on their shoes. But if I picked somebody that wasn't into feelings, they would have had kicked me off. What are you doing? Stop that! Let go of my foot! And I have a real habit of going to empty worlds, you know, looking for stuff. So I probably would have picked somebody that would have tried to kick me off. So I didn't understand that it's okay to be surrounded only by people who support me for what I am at the moment. I didn't understand that. My dearest and closest friends in this program, we've been buddies for 22 years. We worked hard on this male relationship. His mother's the alcoholic, his father was a screaming, insane patriarch, large Italian family, destroyed all the children, beat most of them half to death as they grew up. And so Tom and I have had no conception of a male relationship of any kind. I have no brothers, and I had just had my alcoholic father. So over 22 years, we've worked real hard to get a relationship. I mean, we've cried and yelled at each other and fought and carried on. But today, there's two men there that really love each other no matter what. See, I could call this guy up tomorrow and say, listen, next week I'm going to marry a giraffe. I want you to come be my best man. And he would say to me, is there anything special that you wear to the wedding? You know, striped tie or something? Or, you know. But he would want me to know that he loved me, and he would want me to know that I'm okay, you know. And 2 minutes before the ceremony, he might say, listen, as your best friend, I got to tell you, I don't think this is the best idea you ever had. But I love you anyway. Let's go find the preacher. So, I mean, I never had those kind of relationships, didn't understand them, didn't know how. So when I went to people, I usually picked people that couldn't give it to me anyway, you know. So I immediately, see, there's an intuitive little child lives inside of me, and he knows about people. But he's been real covered up. And you met him. You've all met him. You see, the intuition of a child is perfect. It's perfect. And I think the best example comes from large family gatherings at Christmas. And you got a little one around the house. He's a year and a half, 2 years old. And he'll start across the floor, you know, towards one of the uncles, towards Uncle Harry. You know, little Billy will just take off across the floor, headed for Uncle Harry. He'll get about 4 steps away from Uncle Harry and go, he starts back the other way. Well, Uncle Harry's loved by all. Nobody can allow that. So they pick little Billy up, take him over, carry him, and, well, this is your Uncle Harry. He's so sweet. You sit here on Uncle Harry's lap. And little Billy goes, yeah! Absolutely nuts right off the charts, right? Yelling and screaming, see?
reality is, little Billy's right. Little Billy's right. Little Billy knows something about Uncle Harry nobody else knows. But because I was raised where little Billy or little Bobby just got smashed, I never could trust that intuition. And it spoke to me all my life. It just wasn't loud enough. It didn't speak as loud as alcohol. It didn't speak as loud as heroin. It didn't speak as loud as morphine. The little voice would just say, I don't think this is a good idea. I'd say, oh, shut up. What do you know, man? I've been married 7 times. I don't want to tell you how many times that little voice, I was, walking, the little guy said, I don't think we want to do this. Well, if you have no real identity, you can't change your mind. The only people who are really in touch with who they are can change their mind. Say, oh, geez, you know what? I changed my mind. I can't do this. This is wrong. No, everybody else will go ahead, see, and kill somebody living inside them. So by the time I'm 3 years sober, crazier than I've ever been in my life. In my life. By the time I'm 4 years sober, my life is falling apart. Absolutely crumbling. I've been bankrupt through the courts. I got no car. I'm working at a car wash for $1.25 an hour. I started at $1.35. I can't get a girlfriend. I haven't been laid in so long. By that point, my eyes are crossed. I can't even get anybody to go to coffee. Who knows? Hi, would you like to go to coffee? They see me coming clear across the room. They knew it was bullshit. That boy should be locked up. He looks really crazy. I didn't know that. I just thought, I was misunderstood. I just need somebody to love me, but I'm flawed, so nobody will love me. Oh, what do I do now? Lie. Hi, would you like to go to coffee? the tragedy is most of us can never, say, I just want to be held or have to sleep with somebody instead. And that's as much a male thing as it a female thing. I think women think it's only their side. Forget it, man. We do it as often as you do it, We just want to be hugged, but we'll sleep with you instead of saying, just hold me. Somebody please just hold me. So by the time I'm 5 years sober, absolutely over the edge, wanting to die more than I've ever wanted to die in my life, I scream at God, God's got to help me or I'm finished. God's wonderful. He delivered everything. He gave me a new career as a television writer. God, I got lots of money and people pat me on the back. It was exciting being a writer because I could put all this lunacy to work after all these years. And a lot of violence and crime and... it was great. Somebody said to me, once you write comedy, I said, don't be silly. I don't have any humor to spare. I need it all for life, but I got a lot of this stuff I can afford to get rid of. So I just kept bopping on. How are you, Bob? I'm fine, but I became a writer, made lots of money, had lots of prestige. People say, that's a great script you've written. God, it's really wonderful. Thanks. I had to do it in a hurry and it just fell in. It fell in. Thanks. See you. And I think, what am I going to do when they find me out? What am I going to do when they find out something's wrong with me? What am I going to do when they find out I'm flawed? Then the people in the television industry are going to know I'm flawed. And then the people in AA are going to know I'm flawed. And the people close to me are going to know I'm flawed. And they're going to do to me what was done to me by my parents. They're going to throw me away. They're going to make me go away. And I don't want to go away again. I can't. I'll have to die if I have to go away again. So on the outsides of my life look terrific. On the insides, I couldn't even take a compliment. I couldn't even take a compliment. When somebody said, you did good work, I couldn't say, yeah, I do good work. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I had to make excuses and look at my shoes. And this is recovery, man. This is years sober. Years sober. I had a friend come visit me one day. See, one of the things about having been raised in an oppressive environment is I can't ask questions. I must know everything before I go, so I got to get prepared to go anywhere. I can't just go. I had a friend one time who was raised by in a good household by nurturing and supportive parents who taught him he was important and let him become whoever the hell it was he was supposed to become. He's embarrassing. He'll humiliate you if you go out with him because he'll ask anybody anything anytime if he doesn't understand. We went out to eat our sushi together for the first time, he and I. We went to the sushi bar. Now, I looked, the sushi bar was L-shaped. And so I already picked my seat. My seat was down the end of the corner of this L-shaped sushi bar. Because I'm not a real person, I got to watch you. But if I sit in the corner of that sushi bar, then I can watch you. I can watch what you order and how you order it and what you do to it and how you eat it. And then I can order the same thing and pick it up and eat it the same way and put the same stuff on it, see. Unfortunately, I was with Jim, and this dumb son of a bitch, right? He starts to dip into the sushi bar, clear down here, calls the sushi chef over. Hey, you know, excuse me for a minute. I've never been in a sushi bar before. Oh, my God, let me out of here. Move one step away, you know. Like I'm not with him. Could you come down here and help me, please? You know, and what is this? And why? Where does it come from? As a first-time sushi eater, would I like it, or should I skip it and have it? He did that down the whole goddamn case. You know, everybody in the restaurant's looking. Not everybody, just those who are as fucked up as I am. You know. The other folks are quite happy and content, and they understand someone asking questions. You know, they themselves. I mean, most of our society is not structured that you can ask questions. I'm terrible now. I mean, I've stopped my wife and I driving two doctors right straight over the wall over here in the medical center. You know, we got her and a baby inside of her, and we got questions. We got a lot of questions. And you better answer them, you know, because we ain't going to stop asking them. And if you won't give them to us, we'll get on the phone. You know, we'll find somebody else who'll answer. But people get irritated. Answer questions. Well, you shouldn't. That should be okay to answer questions. Anyway, this same guy one day, I took him to a studio and let him spend a day with me at the studio. He had the best time of his life. He laughed and cheered and shouted and pointed at actors and actresses and made an ass out of himself and, you know, asked questions of the special effects guys and went here and there. He had a great time. He had the best 5 hours. He just had a ball. Finally, I got rid of him. All I could think of was getting him the hell off the studio because he was embarrassing me every time I turned around. Finally, I got rid of him, got him off the studio, and I went back to my office. And occasionally, in your recovery, these little realities will come. This little voice down in here, in the pit of your stomach, will speak to you. You won't like anything it says. Because it usually, everything it says requires risk and spontaneity, and change, and awareness. And this little voice said to me, do you realize he just had more fun with your career in 5 hours than you've had in 10 years? Who learned more about some of the stuff we did on the show I was writing scripts for than I knew working on the show because he asked questions about how is it done. See, I couldn't do that. I rolled into my 17th year of sobriety and nothing in my life had changed. Oh, sure, I look great on the outside. Jesus, sponsoring 75 people, lived in a penthouse apartment at the beach, drove a brand new Seville Cadillac, parked in the garage under contract to 20th Century Fox, making tons of money. And I sat on my bed in this apartment and I wanted to die just as bad as I wanted to die when I was 5 years sober and living in a dumpy little apartment in the valley on disability insurance. Just wanted to die. Wanted to end it all. A friend of mine said to me, I think you should go see a therapist. I'd always been very open-minded to therapy. If I sponsored you and you came to me and told me you were going to see a therapist, I would tell you to get another sponsor. I would tell you, obviously, the Big Book and I aren't enough. Find another sponsor. I was right. I didn't even know I was telling them the truth. Big Book and I weren't enough. I thought it was an insult. It's how stupid I am. Came my turn to go. I had to go. It was that or die. Couldn't think of anybody else to talk to. You know, I couldn't. I knew everybody else too well in AA. Christ, I've been a circuit speaker for years. I know all their skeletons, can't talk to them, you know. I know they're as flawed as I am. They'll love that, all the speakers following me. Poor Dr. Paul, he was in Seattle with me at the 50th anniversary. That was terrible. I don't think he thought we were going to get out of there without being tarred and feathered. That was just a bad night, you know. It was a big celebration, and I was sitting there thinking about all the people who had died sober, and somehow I didn't feel like celebrating. My talk reflected that. We all have our moments, you know, what the hell. Got them going, though. Got a lot of energy in the room, you know. People standing up screaming at you, you know, you got... At least you woke them up. Shit, that's what I'm trying to do, you know, is wake people up. Like as one Al-Anon speaker said one time in Canada, now that you know, you got your own act together, your responsibility is to disturb the comfortable and comfort the disturbed. So I'm here in essence to disturb the comfortable. I mean, I realize that. Don't think I'm up here in some kind of fog and that I'm walking out of here knowing that this stuff ain't uncomfortable and it's not touching the places you don't want to be touched and making you feel stuff you don't want to feel and making you look at stuff you don't want to look at. You don't think I don't know that? I'm up here looking at your faces, man. I'd like to get down on the floor behind the podium, you know. I want to go home now. Anyway, so I go to see this woman. I figure women were my problem. I hadn't had a decent relationship with women. Oh, God, I know where this one's going. I don't even want to think about it. This is really embarrassing, but I'm going to put it out there. I don't know why. I remember one point a couple of years into this process with my therapist, I looked at her. I said, okay, where the hell are we going? You know, what's the point of all this? I mean, what's our goal here? Ultimately, where are we going? This beautiful, gentle woman, and she looked at me, she smiled, she said, we're going to take you to a place in time. I can't believe I'm telling this story. The kid's telling the story. He doesn't care. The kids don't get embarrassed. You know, they shift their drawers and take them off and walk on, you know. No consequence to them, you know. It's got to be the kid telling this story. I wouldn't tell it out here. So she said, I'll tell you where we're going. We're going to go to a place in time where you're going to experience tenderness and your sexuality in the same instant, at the same moment. And I got real quiet. And she asked me her very favorite question. How does that make you feel? I said, well, the first thing it makes me wonder is if I'll be able to get it up. And I said, the second thing it puts me in touch with is that back over all those years, all those broken beds and collapsed chairs and caved-in hoods of cars and collapsed kitchen tables and plaster knocked out of the walls that I labeled passion, was nothing but anger. And I was mad at them because I couldn't be me. I mean, you know, you girls get a bad deal. We all get a bad deal. I mean, I'm looking for mom and I hate her, so you're already in trouble. and the ladies never ever got the attention or that they wanted or needed from their fathers, and so that, you know, they want us to fix it and we can't, so we're screwed. You know, you're uphill from the gate, you know. So the minute you say hi, they want Prince Charming and we want mom. Not a good combination. It's flawed. There'll be some tough moments. Particularly when you turn to each other in need. So no wonder I couldn't have a relationship. You know, I've had all this anger and rage all these years at women, but it's never expressed itself openly and honestly. Yeah. Anyway, when I first sat down with this woman, she said, tell me a little bit about yourself. And I said, well, they threw me out of Manual Arts High School when I was 15 years old, and I discovered the world of drugs and alcohol after they threw me out. I discovered drugs and alcohol. So, needless to say, I had problems before. I said, and I drank alcohol and used drugs for about 11 years, ran the streets, smuggled narcotics. And I said, and I've been clean and sober for 17 years in the programs of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous. She said, wait a minute. I said, tell me a little, she said, tell me a little about yourself starting with your childhood. She said, I said, starting with your childhood. You weren't born at 15 years of age. I said, I don't remember anything. I can't remember anything. It's just black. Now, I want you to understand that by this time, in my sobriety, I had written 32 fourth steps. Okay? I don't want anybody saying, well, if you'd work the inventory step more thoroughly. I worked the inventory step as thoroughly as I could work it. See, you may be able to find all the answers you need to accomplish what I've accomplished, if you even want to accomplish that, within the framework of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You may never, ever need to look elsewhere or turn elsewhere. I'm just saying that there's a lot of us who can't find it completely in that framework, and we do need to look elsewhere, and you don't have a right to try and stop us. See? Permission was granted by our founders to do what you need to do in recovery in order to recover. You know, let's remember who Bill and Dr. Bob were, for Christ's sake. Bill never stopped looking. He never stopped trying new things, seeking new things, going different places. He knew smoking was screwing his life. He tried to quit all of his recovery and was only successful after it was too late, the last couple of years. Dr. Bob, for all those looking for the purity of AA, for Christ's sake, was a drug addict. You know, I mean, come on, guys. Let's get in touch with reality. Bill and Dr. Bob used to hold seances at Dr. Bob's house. We don't even know how much of our program came from the other side, for Christ's sake. You know. The fifth chapter of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was sent to a psychiatrist before it was put into the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous for his suggested changes, and he made some, and they made those changes in the fifth chapter. The three principal speakers at the 20th International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous were a psychiatrist and a Catholic priest and a Protestant minister, none of whom were alcoholics. None of whom were alcoholics. See, did you hear what I said earlier? You get scared, you get panicked, you got no identity, you start pulling down, making your little world smaller. We've never been intended to be small. This outfit has never been intended to be a little secret closed kind of organization in little meeting halls locked up, man, with kind of all these goddamn conditions on whether or not you speak, don't speak, you know, you come, you don't come. That's never been the intention. It was always, here we are, come in, sit down, you know, man, you got problems, we love you, and it's intended to be that. We're meant to be big. We're meant to be open. You know, not closed. If you need a small little closed meeting for you to be comfortable in, it's only pure alcoholics by God started. You have a right to it, and you should. But don't try and change the one that you're going to now. Leave it be. You know, start your own. See, that's how this thing got big anyway. Start your own. A lot of people have found a lot of problems. You know, the 12 steps are being used for everything now. You know, Debtors Anonymous, Sex Anonymous, ACA, Al-Anon, NA, GA. I mean, they're out there like, you know, you think they're like handing them out on the street corner like Jehovah's Witnesses. Here's 12 steps. Take them to your organization and enjoy yourself. Some people don't like that. I think it's wonderful. I think it's absolutely wonderful. So anyway, I couldn't remember my childhood. Some of you will keep up with me. Others of you won't, and it's okay. So she impressed upon me that it was necessary to go back and find out what happened to me the first 15 years of my life. And until I found that out, I'd never find out who the hell I was or what I was about. What did I discover? I discovered that my father was an uncommunicative alcoholic who was drunk from the time I was born until he left when I was about, 13, I guess. I discovered that I was beaten senseless from about age 1.5 to about age 5.5 by my mother. Brutalized on a constant basis. Just absolutely so badly I couldn't go. I missed so much school. My first year of school, they wouldn't even give me a grade. You know. Now, I mean, if I went and tried to confront her with this, she's 80 years old. She probably wouldn't even remember it. At least my therapist's contention is she's got it buried so deep She doesn't remember. So all this process of going back and digging up all this stuff that happened to me when I was a kid has got nothing to do with making them bad people. And you start talking about doing this stuff in recovery and everybody gets uncomfortable. Well, you bet we get uncomfortable because, God damn it, we were destroyed as children and we turned around and we handed the same crap on to our kids. You know? Swore we wouldn't and did it. Absolutely swore we wouldn't do it to our children and we did it to our children. So it's real goddamn uncomfortable. But I heard a guy say one time, talking to a large gathering of parents who were there in this facility because their children were all drug addicts. And by the way, if you want to do any studies about being raised in an alcoholic home, the addict is the acting out child. He's the child that acts out, takes the heat off the family. Now they can focus on him. God, he's driving us fucking crazy. I mean, they were crazy before. You know, it's got nothing to do with what the kid's doing. It's just a nice focus. Oh, if we could ever just stop him. He's in jail. He's in jail. He's in here. This psychiatrist in this group of parents, he said, if you think you can work out your stuff with these children in this program before you work out your stuff with your parents, you're nuts. Just getting sober don't make you a good parent. If you just got sober, you got kids, buy a book on how to be a parent. Because the odds are you don't know. Oh, this is, I know, this is making friends. Jesus, whoa. Welcome to Yosemite, Bob. Have a nice day. Thanks. I think I will. I'll sum it up. I have never found a way better to sum the whole process up than this. A girl I knew was celebrating her first birthday on the program. Her mother, who was 4 years sober, had not 3 cents to her name and wanted to buy her a present and couldn't buy her a present. So her mother called her on the phone to give her what she thought was a meaningless, valueless birthday present in her first year of sobriety. She said, hey, look, on this your first birthday, all I can give you is this. I want you to know that from what I've learned, I understand that I, your mother, am responsible for most of the problems you have in your life today. I'm responsible for the fact that you can't have a relationship with a man. I'm responsible for the fact that you're such a lousy mother that my ex-husband, your father, is raising your children. I'm responsible for the fact that you don't know how to hold a job. I'm responsible for the fact that you don't know how to relate to other people. I'm responsible for the fact that you don't know how to take care of yourself. She says, for most of the problems in your life today, I'm responsible. She said, but on this your first birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous, please understand, you're responsible for the solution. She gave her the greatest gift anybody could give anybody. She said, look, man, it's not your fault. You're the way you are. Stop torturing yourself because you are the way you are. And stop pretending to be somebody else because you are the way you are. It ain't your fault. It's not your fault. But you gotta fix it. God, I can live with that. All my life I thought it was my fault. See, all my life I thought something was wrong with me. I thought I was beaten senseless because I did something wrong. No, the verdict is in. If you hit a kid, it's wrong. Well, that's it. I remember not long ago, I was flying home to New Mexico, and I changed planes, and Phoenix got on the plane, sat down next to this little kid. He's about 8 years old. Kids love me on planes, because they've never seen a kid this big, you know. And whatever they do, I'll do. You know, they want to stand in the seat, I'll stand in the seat. Then we go, I'll go, and usually I have a bear to give them the holes, you know, so... So, and this kid, he says, can I put my hand in your lap? I mean, they just take to me. If you want to find out your own relationship with your inner child, go find a small child and look in their eyes. I'll bet you money you'll look away before they do. Children love eye contact and don't get it. Look in the eyes of anybody's child. Look in the eyes of a child on a mother's shoulder. Just see that child. If there's a person there, and watch the look you get back from the kid. They'll go... There's a connection made. It's wonderful. Anyway, this kid put his head in my lap after a while. He sat up. He said, I'm mad at my dad. I gave him a teddy bear to hold. And he said, I'm real mad at my dad. I said, why are you mad at your dad? He said, because my dog died and it's his fault. And I said, why do you say that? He said, my dad didn't let the dog out of the yard and he got hit by a car. And he knew if he let him out of the yard, he'd get killed. And I said, gee, I don't think your dad did that intentionally, you know. He says, oh, yes, he did. He says, he's not a nice guy, my dad. You know, he says, my dad, he hits me here, you know, and he hits me here, and he hits me here, you know. He hits my mom, and nobody's going to hit my mom, you know. He says, I'm coming from Grandpa's, and Grandpa's coming back here in 2 weeks, and this stuff's going to stop, you know, because nobody's going to hit my mom. Oh, God, and part of me inside just died. This is not long ago, but it's before I was in touch with all the beatings I had gotten. And I got off the plane in Albuquerque. The kid was going on to Tulsa. And I ran in. I thought 2 weeks is too long, man. If I'm preaching all this bullshit, I got to be a responsible citizen and get in the middle of this. You know, you can't turn your head. So I go to the airport police in Albuquerque, tell them the story. Unfortunately, they weren't interested, and I did not behave like someone AA would be proud of. I'll talk to them someday. I'll go back and tell them I'm not sorry for what I said, just the way I said it. And I thought, this ain't good enough, and I went and I got on a payphone, and I called Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I got the police in downtown, and they wouldn't really give a shit, and they put me on to the police. They have a precinct at the airport or whatever, and I got a cop on the phone at the airport in Omaha that cared. And he says, yeah. He says, listen, I'll tell you what, don't worry. He said, we'll get on the plane. An officer will get on the plane before anyone can get off, and we'll sit down with the boy, and we'll talk to him, and we'll see what we can do to bring a stop to it. And I hung up the phone and I just died, and I sat in that booth and I sobbed and sobbed and sobbed and cried, and I didn't understand why, you know. And later on I went back to LA and talked to my doctor because I was going through all this turmoil over people having been beaten and having no conscious memory of it myself. And the conscious memory of it came, and she said to me, look, she said, what you did for that little boy was what you wish somebody would have done for you. That somebody would have stopped the beatings just once. Well, you know, now what really gets me angry is this is reality. See, this is part of my life. This is part of who created what I am today. And I'm not supposed to express this stuff according to some people. Right? And then people go to ACA meetings, and you know the rap they give adult children. Boy, I hear so much horseshit. I heard one speaker say, if you go to a second 12-step program, it will dilute your primary program. I wish they would say for me. You know, just say for me. I heard a woman say one time, if you go to ACA, you feel sorry for yourself the rest of your life. Well, that can't be from her own experience because she ain't dead. You know what I mean? I don't know where the hell she drew that one up. But the rap you get is, if you go to adult children, they live in the problem. There's no solution there. You go to those goddamn meetings and those people are crying and pounding on the tables and carrying on. I'm explaining something to you. This comes from the experts, not just some fruitcake standing in an orchard, you know, exposing himself. The problem with children raised in an adult and in a household of alcoholics is that when they get to be adults, they are either absolutely, totally, completely out of touch with their feelings, or if they are in touch with them, they can't express them. If you walk into a room where there's people gathered who were raised by alcoholics and they are crying or yelling or pounding on the table, they're in recovery. I've spent my whole life in recovery walking around not being okay. Being flawed. And I know, damn it, that wasn't what was intended. Today, if somebody asked me how do I view all this stuff, man, I see nutrition, exercise, therapy, 4 a.m. trampoline meditation classes on the top of Mount Whitney, all of it, I don't care where you go, what you do, find your path and do it because they're all tools of God. They're all provided by Him to help me getting back to being happy, joyous, and free, which is what the hell He had intended me to be in the first place. And my tools may not be your tools, but that's okay. Neither one of us are wrong. I'm not wrong, you're not wrong. If it was only one way for all of us, we would all go to the same goddamn meeting in California. There'd be one meeting a month and everybody would go. You know? And we'd all walk in like, well, we're here for the meeting, you know? That ain't it. It's not it. And since I started this process and started to work on some of this stuff and started to care about taking care of myself, man, the only time I ever saw a dentist is when I had a toothache. And I'm talking in recovery. When I had a toothache, the only time I ever saw a doctor was in the emergency room. You know, because it's gone too far. Because I can't take care of myself. I don't know how to take care of myself. I wait till I'm so sick or so in pain. Or there's one of my best friends inflicts pain on himself because the pain stops the feeling. If he can hit his thumb with a hammer, then he can focus on this, on the thumb. And he doesn't have to focus on the fact that he doesn't feel good inside, or that he's afraid, or that he hurts. Geez, I'm afraid. I hurt, you know. I've been to tons of meditation classes and tons of therapy and tons of everything. How do I feel about God today? My wife and I represent 37 years of sobriety. We probably represent 20 years of therapy. And forget all the other stuff, okay? Don't forget, it's all actually kind of fun and important, as lunatic as some of it was. And when we pray in the morning, we sit in bed and we hold each other like two children. Like two little children. And we talk to God like two little children. Until we got the house, which we know He provided. We even used to tell Him where we were. You know? Well, God, good morning. Here we are. On Kaya Mejia, apartment 312. You know, and if we're mad at somebody, we tell God we're mad. And if we're scared because there's not enough money, we tell Him we're scared because there's not enough money. Would He please help us out? And we really would appreciate it if you'd help Mike out, God. We realize he's an asshole and he doesn't deserve it, but help him anyway. You know? And I mean, we pray like two little tiny children because what I believe is this, you know, if God made me, if I'm going to go along with this program that I made what I am, God made me a human being. You know what comes along with being a human being? Feelings! Huh? That's part of being a human being. Watch a child before anybody had a chance to get to them. Man, they can go in a 5-minute period of time in a sandbox. They can go through the whole lifetime. They can go laughter, happiness, giggling, silly, tears, sobbing, disaster, toy-breaking anger. And 5 minutes later, they don't remember any of it because they expressed it all. See? And then we spend our time trying to hold that stuff in. How are you, Bob? I'm fine. Thanks. Instead of saying, I'm not fine. I feel goddamn awful, you know? I want to die. Would somebody hold me? Would somebody please help me? I believe God wants me to be a human being. See, I was always afraid that if I felt afraid, or I was angry, or I was sad, that I had to fix that first, then pray. See, God didn't want me until I fixed the feeling. Because I grew up in a home where I wasn't wanted unless I fixed the feeling and got quiet and got out of the way. So I couldn't talk to God till I fixed the feeling. Now I realize God wants me to have the feeling. God loves me if I'm scared to death. God loves me if I'm so sad I'm sobbing. God loves me if I'm so mad I'm kicking it inside of my car and breaking my toe. You know, God didn't stop loving me just because I dented my car. My car may have. I've got to talk to it when I get home. You know, I feel very bad about that. My wife says, it's okay, cars understand. I don't know. Where has all this gotten me? I think we're at the end of this thing. I'm sure we must be. I don't have glasses on. I can't see a schedule. Where has all this gotten you, Bob? I'm glad you asked. Got me into Yosemite Village with two frozen windshield wipers and a wife in the medical center. Where it's gotten me is this. God, I'm 52 years old, 25 years old, about to be a daddy. I can't tell you how excited I am about that. We'll go to all the class. Yeah. Yeah, I did it too. It's just so, I mean, I just learned a real good lesson the other day. We've been going to all these goddamn medical classes, you know, they show you pictures of where the baby is and how the baby is, and I don't know any of that stuff, right? I mean, when my two daughters were born, I was doing more drugs than they were giving my wife in the labor room, you know. I had no concept of reality or what was going on in there, and they didn't let you in there anyway, you know. I was sitting out in the father's room. So they show you all these drawings and models, and here's the baby, and the head is here, and the butt, and the thing. And I looked at all the pictures and looked at all the models and couldn't connect. I could not connect. You know, I watched and it just didn't connect. And yesterday, or no, last week, Tuesday, we were watching a film on how to take care of your baby the first few days after he was born. And this woman was showing how you swaddle a baby. You wrap it up, and you make a triangle out of a blanket, and you wrap it up. And in essence, you place the baby. She said, now the baby is used to having its hands, you know, so we put the hands up by the mouth because she had the hands in the womb, and wrap the blanket here, and then the baby's feet are tucked up. So she said a small amount of pressure, and the baby will pull the feet up by herself because, you know, they know where they want to go. And then wrap the blanket here and get the... And I said, oh, and the light went on. The light went on. I said, oh, okay, I understand now how, because the doctors have tried to show us, and you show me, I mean, well, I understand, here's the baby's head, and, you know, I've been like, oh, you know, I don't understand, you know. I think the reason we play football and lift weights, guys, is because we don't have children. I've watched some films on childbirth, I gotta tell you, I don't know. I don't think we could do it. So, at 52, and I started to write books now, so the television, I'm changing my whole life, my career, it's a complete risk. 25 years sober, going to be a daddy, and yes, I'm aware of the fact I'll be 70 when the kid graduates from high school. The thought has crossed my mind. Dad, do you want to go to the park and play flag football with the other dads? That's why I'm in the gym 5 days a week. Because, yeah, I do want to go play football with the other dads when I'm 70 years old. The most important thing out of all of this that happens is today, occasionally, when I walk past a plate glass window, I get a reflection of myself. And I see me standing there. And I smile. I smile. Because there's a person here now. I found a human being. I found the guy who lives inside of me. And he's flawed, by the way. But you know what's nice about finding my flaws is that I can let you have yours. And we can really love each other. And I look at this guy, and I see the God in him that I always look for in everybody else. And I see the respect in him that I always look for from everybody else. And it's such a wonderful feeling to just be standing there and just be a man, you know, sober, clean, working on becoming happy, joyous, and free, and getting ready to have a baby girl. It's a girl we're going to have, and hoping to God that it can stop with her. You know, that it can stop with her. Now, we're also a realist, my wife and I. We realize genetically this kid is on the loser side of the wheel. So before we set aside a college fund, we will set aside a bail bond fund, you know. Just in case. We're going to do the best job we can, but you never know. So why did I come here from the medical center at 9:30 this morning? I came here to just tell you, man, that it's been necessary for me to use a lot of tools in recovery in order to recover. Physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual tools. And I'm glad now in my life that I'm surrounded by people who give me absolute permission to go where I have to go and do what I have to do to find out who I am. That's all, just so I can be who I am. And that's really what these 12 steps are designed to do. But some of us just can't quite get it with just those steps, you know. So we need these other tools. And I'm just saying to you, find your path. Find your path, man, and walk it. Because the person that you bring back to AA is going to be a much better tool for God to use, you know. And I just want you... I'm just saying to the little child that lives inside of you, that to the little children in the audience, be patient. Be patient. These folks will come meet you someday, children. And the little bear says, thank you very much for your attention. God bless you all.